Welcome to Access Utah. A recent study released by the Natural Resources Defense Council, a national non-for-profit environmental group, shows taxpayers spend roughly $1,000 per year in extreme weather events related to climate change. Today on the program, economist Laura Johnson joins us to talk about the monetary, environmental, and health costs of climate change. And she offers solutions to work towards a cleaner energy future. At 9:30, Science Questions explores the ethical implications of new findings in the field of epigenetics. For instance, can aggressive behavior be blamed on bad genes in court? That is at 9:30. This will be coming up after the news.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Open Monday through Saturday until 2 with a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Global climate change has emerged as a major scientific and public policy issue. Accumulated carbon dioxide emitted from the burning of fossil fuels, along with other human-induced greenhouse gas emissions, are leading to warmer surface temperatures. Current consequences of this temperature increase include heightened storm intensity, altered precipitation patterns, sea level rise, reversal of ocean currents, and increased frequency of extreme temperature events, such as heat waves. While Greenland ranks one of the coldest spots on Earth, it is getting warmer. Greenland is so important because there is enough ice there to raise the world's oceans by more than 20 feet, which would devastate island nations and coastal cities worldwide. The latest projections of sea level rise by the end of this century still stand at about 3 to 6 feet. That's going to be plenty destructive, agree scientists. There is considerable disagreement within and among nations as to what policies should be introduced to mitigate and prevent climate change and its impacts. Despite the disagreements, in recent years, we have witnessed the gradual emergence of a range of international and domestic climate change policies, including emissions taxes and technology-promoting programs. As new details continue to emerge, are we as a society and as individuals doing enough? Laurie Johnson, Chief Economist for the Natural Resources Defense Council, joins us to discuss climate change and the need, she says, to act more now.
We're a nonprofit, and we have 1.4 million activists and members, and we work to protect the public health and the environment by making sure that there's good policies and legislation for the environment and public health. And furthermore, that they get enforced, both in terms of the government doing what it's supposed to do and firms doing what they're supposed to do. And we have a lot of scientists and lawyers and economists as well. So we work to try to make things better for everybody.
The council released a report this week detailing some of the cost of climate-related natural disasters. Federal spending to pay for climate change-related storms, wildfires, floods, and drought reached nearly $100 billion in 2012. A note of caution here. While Johnson delivers some of the bad news that has been coming out in recent years, she also addresses solutions that could help mitigate the problems.
We certainly have the ability to reduce our emissions, but the political process has been very difficult in getting anything done or getting enough done. The costs, we just did a study. You just want to take a look at what taxpayers are currently paying because we are seeing a lot of extreme events. We can't say anything really about the tornadoes because we don't have enough information about how those relate to climate change. But what our study did look at was storms and wildfires, floods, droughts. We looked at government insurance programs and government expenditures on emergency relief. And what we found was that the average taxpayer in 2012 had to spend $1,100 to deal with these incidents. And the thing that is really disturbing, I think, about this is that it's happening already, and we know it's going to get worse, and we're basically accumulating a huge climate disruption tax that we are going to be passing on to our children. That's only going to get bigger the more we sit around and do nothing and let the fossil fuel industry continue burning every last drop that it has in its reserves.
Meanwhile, the global pumping of oil is pumping massive amounts of climate-changing gases into the atmosphere, and hydraulic fracturing for the extraction of natural gas is emitting dangerous levels of greenhouse gases, too.
We're doing exactly what we should not be doing, and we know that we can do what we want to do and what we should do. Actually, one more thing about this study that we found that was very surprising was that this was the largest ticket item of non-defense discretionary spending. It was more than we spend on education, more than we spend on transportation, the federal government. And in fact, the taxpayers have been stepping in over private insurance, which has just left the market and is leaving it because it's not profitable. So taxpayers in 2012 outspent, so to speak, the private insurance sector by 3-1. And that trend is increasing, and the government is basically not able to cover all the expenditures it's required to pay out because it's not collecting enough premiums to cover the increasing expenditures and climate disasters. So that was disturbing. But in terms of where we can go, I think we can do a lot. We've already done a lot, which is something a lot of people don't know. But we don't need Congress now, the one that's not working. We had the Clean Air Act passed bipartisan under the Nixon administration. It's been wildly very, very successful in making our environment so much cleaner. And the president and the Environmental Protection Agency, per the Supreme Court, are legally obligated to regulate greenhouse gases. They've done a lot already, but where they have to go next is with the power plant sector, which right now emits 40% of our carbon emission pollution. So let me say a little more about what we have done, because we always want to hear good things too, not just the bad. This administration has actually done more to reduce emissions than any prior, and we've done it through ways that have been very helpful to consumers, in particular the fuel economy standards for new cars and trucks. We're going to actually reduce our emissions by half by 2025, and at the same time reduce our gas bill by a half, so we go twice as far on a gallon of gas. That's a very large emissions reduction. We also, under the administration, strengthened efficiency standards, and also the stimulus bill spent money on renewables and clean energy. And right now, really the next big ticket item are power plants to modernize our electricity system. And we just also did an analysis to show how we could do that and how we could do it in a way that's fair to states. States have different energy types of mixes. And as is always the case with the Clean Air Act, the estimated benefits are much, much higher than the costs. So we estimated $25 to $60 billion in public health and environment benefits for a cost of $4 billion. That's in 2020, so these are annualized benefits and costs. So that's a very, very good investment. The investments we're making now, as you said, in these fossil sectors are bad investments because on net, they're actually making us worse off.
Coal is the dirtiest and ultimately most expensive kind of power, according to Johnson.
Right now, I've done some research, which is in submission for review in a journal, looking at the pollution costs. If you add those to what we pay on our electric bill, and you look at existing coal plants, if you add those costs, it can be up to like 35 cents per kilowatt hour, which doesn't mean anything to anybody, but on your bill is about probably 11 cents, somewhere around that. So it's really three times as much as what we're actually seeing. Those are just the damages we can measure. So it's a very bad return. And if you look at what it costs to basically replace some of these facilities with cleaner energy, which can range from 8 cents for wind to about 13 cents per kilowatt hour for solar photovoltaic, we can do that, which is much less expensive, and also creates the kind of jobs we want to create, and it doesn't have all these bad pollution spills that we are associated with drilling, all the burning of fossil fuels, which, quite apart from climate change, it gives us millions of cases of asthma. Tens of thousands of people die every year from the air pollution that is emitted from burning fossil fuels, coal in particular. And then we look at our Gulf, we look at our streams and waters where coal mines are, where the, you know, mountaintops are literally just chopped off. There's these very, very high costs. We send people to war to protect our access to oil. You know, we lose in lives. We have vulnerability to price shocks from being dependent on oil. I could go on and on, but the point is that it's so expensive to do what we're doing, and it's so much cheaper to do what we should be doing.
In Utah, along the Wasatch Front and in the Uinta Basin, air quality has been at the forefront of recent human health concerns. All that sustains us, what we breathe, eat, and drink, are comforts we need to start worrying about, according to Johnson.
The fact that the food supply and our water supply is greatly under stress, and we can expect it to be more so, is concern for anybody anywhere in the world, because that affects food prices. It affects basically what people have gone to war over for centuries, which is food and water. And so that, I think, is what I think is the scariest thing for me, that concerns me the most about climate change, is the potential for these conflicts to accelerate. What it means for disaster relief, for the extreme weather events, that's a whole other issue. It's also serious. But if you look at the different geographies, mountains that have lots of snow, we need that for our water supply. It's melting. We have shorter seasons. We make it a whole bunch in one big dump, and then it melts. The crops have been affected by changing when the frost happened. You might get early blooms, and then you get a frost, and the whole crop is killed. You have excess heat. Crops get killed. Our ranchers are having to kill their stock, their livestock, because they can't feed them. Obviously, the coastline problems are serious. A lot of things that people don't, one thing that people do not know is happening everywhere, more in some places than others, is infectious diseases. So Lyme's disease, West Nile, these, especially Lyme's disease, well, West Nile can kill, but Lyme's disease can cause permanent cognitive brain damage. And I know a few people personally who have that, who are on permanent disability, and that's been rising very high. Another thing that people don't really notice or realize is the amount of pollen has increased dramatically, and that's really increasing incidence of asthma. And so that's a big public health concern. And the heat increases smog, which is when you have these warnings that say, oh, you should not go out, or your children should not go out today because it's a dangerous air pollution day. Climate heat actually accelerates some of that ozone smog pollution.
Longer tick breeding seasons are contributing to the increase in Lyme's disease. Other forest and agricultural pests are thriving due to the warming conditions. Forests in the Rocky Mountains have been devastated by the pine bark beetle.
Literally, thousands and thousands of acres of trees are dead, are dying, and they create not a timber box. That's why we've had dramatic increase in forest fires, uncontrolled forest fires. Actually, Utah had 74 large fires last year.
In a May 19, 2013, New York Times article, reporter Michael Wines published this story called Wells Dry, Fertile Plains Turn to Dust. Seems to me an example of the predictions of Cadillac Desert. The article describes the drying out of the High Plains aquifer that stretches beneath Wyoming to the Texas Panhandle. It waters prime farmland, but it's fading away.
Moreover, if you start looking at what's happening, if that Keystone pipeline gets built, another bad investment, that's going to be threatening our ranchers and our water supplies, our watersheds as well. Actually, we just learned, science has told us, that the entire gas pipeline system from the mine mouth to your home, all the leaks are the second biggest source of greenhouse gas pollution. After power plants. It's tremendous. It's huge. I don't know if you have heard anything about in Boston, they've done this metering, and they've actually been measuring, you know, methane leaks, gas leaks from the pipe system. Well, we've just discovered that that's a very large source of greenhouse gases, not just burning it, just getting it to places.
Methane is a major culprit in parts of Utah as well. Levels of ozone pollution in the Uinta Basin reached 139 parts per billion, nearly double the federal health standard in 2011. An analysis of the pollution there, conducted by the Utah Department of Environmental Quality, showed the primary source is from oil and gas operations.
We're drilling ourselves into oblivion if we keep doing what we're doing. If we let the fossil fuel industry burn everything that it has, we will be letting them, A, create the biggest probably criminal offense against humanity, given what we now know. If they burn 20% of what they have right now, we will go right up to the amount of carbon dioxide and carbon concentration in the atmosphere where scientists say is dangerous, where we don't want to go above 2-degree increase in global average temperatures. And we are very close to getting there. We just hit 400 parts per million. 450 is the place where scientists say we're really entering the major danger zone. That's much worse than what we're seeing here. We're talking about huge ice sheet collapses, very large sea level rises, sort of runaway feedback effects that are not what we're looking at just with these extreme events. And we're 14 years away from that level of CO2 emissions if we don't do anything about it.
There is hope. We are making progress, despite the wasted energy that continues.
We should be doing the power plants. We absolutely should be modernizing our electricity system and not only replacing the bad stuff, but building whatever new stuff we have from clean energy. And passing renewable portfolio standards, that's a really jargony, nerdy term, but what it means is telling utilities, this is, you have to produce a certain amount from these different renewable sources. And we also want to increase our energy efficiency programs, which save billions of dollars. That's the cheapest form of emissions reduction because it actually can save us money. It's a very low-hanging fruit, they would say. But there's so much waste. I look around every day where, I'll go into the gym and every single TV will be on. People run the water when they're brushing their teeth, 2 gallons of water. Those kinds of things are everywhere. We're not even doing sort of the basic, very low-cost things that we can be doing. But all the investments we can make, we can invest in green infrastructure. We can make our cities much, much more green, which will absorb water when it floods rather than running off into waterways, flooding everywhere. If we create greener cities, we'll be able to catch a lot of that water. We'll create a better environment. There's actually studies now showing less crime, better public health outcomes where people have nicer living environments. There's a lot of pluses to doing things that we should have been doing anyway, but that we really now have to be doing.
One city making significant progress on the clean energy front is Philadelphia. One popular strategy there is green roofing, covering rooftops with vegetation.
You know, if you put a green roof on, you can reduce your energy use by some very large amount, 25%. I'm not sure what it is, but the top of your roof can decrease by as much as 70 degrees because you're not absorbing all that heat from the black roof. So there's lots and lots of things like that. They cost money up front, but like I said, we're already paying so much in our climate disruption that these investments are, A, they're investments. They make things better in many different ways. But, B, they're actually cheaper than not doing anything. So, the clean energy stuff is actually well within our reach. It's not anywhere near as expensive as it used to be. The costs are coming down very fast. Germany has half of their, on a good day, and they have much worse sun than we do, but on a good day, they get 50% of their electricity from solar, which is really remarkable. And they've done it because they made a commitment to do it. And it's been expensive. But the subsidies are being phased out, as they're supposed to be, as was planned. And people all over Germany are benefiting. It's at a very, decentralized level where people are feeding back extra energy to the meter, to the utility grid, and making profits when they're not using energy. So it's basically spreading the wealth instead of having big, big, huge utilities everywhere. It's spreading the wealth of energy across in a very democratic way in the country. So you have a very large constituency of people that are very, very supportive of clean energy. Americans are very supportive of clean energy. They would be even more so if we had more farmers who could make money off of wind turbines. They make like $8,000 per wind turbine, and they can farm their land at the same time. That would be great, to give that income to farmers. Germany requires the grid to buy back energy from homes that are producing more energy than they consume on their solar units. So there's things that we should be doing to help everyday people in addition at the same time as dealing with the climate problem. I think where we really want to focus our attentions are we have to think about what we're leaving for our children. While it makes very bad economic sense what we're doing for ourselves, we're imposing costs on ourselves much greater than the benefits we're getting, but to do this and to know that it's going to get worse for our children, I think is just deeply unethical. It's one thing what you decide to do to yourself, but what you do to future generations is of greater, I think, moral weight. We are right now squabbling over discretionary spending and the sequester and making scenes out of things like the Solyndra, which was only, it was millions of dollars, but it was actually, in the bigger picture, a successful overall research program within the Department of Energy, much, much more successful than the private sector, and there's very good reasons for that in terms of why we have public investment in research and development. And basically, penny wise and pound foolish. We're saving pennies, trying to scrimp here and there today to impose a huge tax on our children in the future. And it's not rational. It doesn't make economic sense, and it doesn't make ethical sense.
To learn more about the impacts of climate change and solutions, Lori Johnson suggests visiting their website at nrdc.org.
You'll get several things. We've got a 2020 list of extreme events you can actually put in your county, get the information at the county level, what extreme events happened. We also have a public health website, which looks at all the impacts in around 2011 and back. We also just did a water report, so vulnerabilities of water resources. So I strongly encourage your listeners to just go and explore. You can just click on your state. In some instances, you put in your county and find out what's happened. So we have a few of those sites that are good. And then there's, of course, places you can click and take action.
Thank you for tuning in. Sherry Quinn for Access Utah.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Mountain West Bank, a community bank offering a variety of services and summer loan options for consumers. At 110 South in Brigham City, information is at mountainwestbank.com. It's a division of Glacier Bank. Programming is also made possible by USU Human Resources.
Waste not. Install a rain sensor on your irrigation controller so your system won't run when it's raining. Also, install water-wise fixtures and appliances.
Waste Not is made possible by the Logan City Public Works Water Conservation Department. Information at loganutah.org/publicworks.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Susie Montgomery.
And I'm Sherry Quinn.
The show today is the fifth in an ongoing series on epigenetics. But today we're looking at it from a bit of a different angle, an ethical one. Moshe Shef, a renowned epigeneticist, was propelled into the spotlight with his work on how early life experiences influence people's genes, was once asked by a defense attorney to testify in court that the defendant had epigenetic evidence that he was abused as a child, an alibi of sort to his violent crime.
We knew that abuse isn't good, but I think what epigenetics is giving hard molecular marks for that and hard evidence in science. So it's not anymore the magic of somehow abuse causes bad behavior later in life, but there is a chemical process that that leads from abuse to changes in behavior or to changes in health. That has policy implications. Policy making people depends on their education and intelligence. Some of them are getting interested.
New epigenetic research is putting into question a flood of ethical questions, like who is responsible and accountable for harmful toxins put into our environment that affect our health, when we are now beginning to trace the harm back generations and are able to accuse our ancestors of leaving epigenetic marks on our DNA, now showing up and driving our behavior and affecting our health, making us susceptible to disease. But for those of you just tuning into the series, in the past shows, we've heard from three of the nation's leading scientists in the field of epigenetics, Randy Driddle, Michael Skinner, and Moshe Sheff. One of Driddle's main areas of focus is the link between in utero exposure to toxins, mainly from plastics, and obesity. Skinner is famous for his work on how environmental factors influence the development of male and female gonads, the testes and the ovaries. Moshe Sheff for his work on how early life experiences influence people's genes.
To me, it's a story. I'm telling a story with people. Mendel said that there's selection, positive or negative, for variations. But there's another type of way in which you can get variation, and that is through epigenetic changes, programs, changes in the programs that give rise to variation also. Then it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that when you alter these epigenetic programs that give rise to these variations through environmental exposures, etc., that has a great potential now of creating what we call diseases, like cancer, and neurological disorders like schizophrenia, autism, bipolar disease, etc.
This is a big deal because this could explain why disease can increase over several generations at a very dramatic rate that can't be explained by genetics, but it can be explained by epigenetics and transgenerational sort of things.
We have been working for 20 years, we means the field, on understanding how DNA methylation is involved in cellular differentiation and explaining how, you know, one genome can have multiple phenotypes in a human or in an animal that is a multicellular organism. But we always thought that once an organism is completed at birth, that's it. The methylation pattern doesn't change. We also thought that DNA methylation pattern is similar amongst individuals. So nobody looked into DNA methylation as a source of inter-individual variation. I never bought this idea that DNA methylation is fixed. There's no reaction in biology that is fixed. They're all reversible at some point.
Epigenetics research holds great promise for showing us pathways from environmental exposure to phenotypic expression, or in other words, observable characteristics in people. And this, Driddle predicts, will play a major role in the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of a wide range of disorders and diseases. And it doesn't stop there. The ethical implications of epigenetics will change the world forever. Think about it. A key implication of epigenetics research is that many environmental and hazardous exposures will affect not only the exposed individuals, but generations down the line. It could be that each generation will have an obligation to its descendants not to damage the genomes and epigenomes of future generations. A key implication of epigenetics research is that many environmental and hazardous exposures will affect not only the exposed individuals, but generations down the line. It could be that each generation will have an obligation to its descendants not to damage the genomes and epigenomes of future generations, ending up in a slew of new environmental policies. Then there is environmental justice. If epigenetic effects have been associated with exposure to various toxic chemicals, airborne pollutants, pesticides, and other harmful substances, isn't it unfair to expose one group of people over another? And that many of these exposures are linked with poverty, discriminatory land use, and substandard living and working conditions could provide us with a new window for addressing these inequalities. Equitable health care will also be on the table, especially in countries like the U.S., where many of the people most likely to be exposed will be less likely to have regular, timely, and comprehensive health care.
As far as I know, there have been 3 published papers on ethical issues in epigenetics, and I wrote 2 of them. Epigenetics has been ignored so far in the law, and I think it's just a matter of time, however, before there are going to be many applications of it.
Mark Rothstein is a bioethicist from the Louisville School of Medicine in Kentucky.
lawsuits are always at the front of new discoveries, and epigenetics could prove a mechanism that links environmental exposures with effects.
Epigenetics could provide a mechanism that links environmental exposures with effects. So today it's sort of a black box. Environmental exposure to benzene causes leukemia. Not all people who are exposed to benzene get leukemia. Not all people who get leukemia are exposed to benzene. So if you have someone who's been exposed to benzene and gets leukemia and wants to recover for their huge medical bills and so forth, and sues the person or the entity who exposed them, what do they have to prove to show that their exposure to benzene caused their leukemia? Well, scientifically, you can't prove that. But legally, the courts have developed a sort of a shorthand way to do that, and they look at the relative risk. And the plaintiff would have to show that the relative risk was 2.0 or greater in order to say that X caused Y, even though as a matter of science, there is no such thing. Well, epigenetics might provide the biomarker of not only exposure but effect that links the exposure with the effect, and so that would totally change the way people prove that they were harmed from environmental exposures. Another example in the personal injury litigation is the DES litigation. It's a xenoestrogen that was used to try to prevent miscarriages for about 25 years, starting in the late 40s to the early 1970s. And it caused adenocarcinoma and a variety of other unique neoplasms and disorders to the reproductive tracts of the mothers, as well as the daughters who were in utero at the time of the exposure taking these drugs. And those two groups, so the mothers and the daughters, sued successfully against the manufacturers of the products. Well, it turns out that the granddaughters, in some cases, were also affected through various epigenetic processes, and the granddaughters, in some cases, sued the manufacturers and lost. And the reason they lost was the courts said, we have to draw the line somewhere, and we're going to allow two generations of recovery, and that's it. So would greater knowledge of the epigenetic mechanism through which the granddaughters were affected change the way the courts look at these kinds of cases? And the answer is, who knows?
It's hard to say what toxic exposures will get the most attention in law and policy. PAH, or potent atmospheric pollutants, and BPA, bisphenol A, are likely to get much of it, according to Rothstein. PAHs occur in oil, coal, and tar deposits and are produced as byproducts of fuel burning. Some compounds in these pollutants have been known to cause cancer, gene mutations, and birth defects. They're also found in cooked foods. High levels of PAH exposures are found in meat cooked at high temperatures and in smoked fish. BPA is one of the organic compounds used to make plastics.
They're very common, and some of the work that's being done at Columbia that points out the damage to children and from their exposures, I think certainly BPA and the epigenetics, that may go a long way to put some pressure on to regulate.
The mounting evidence on the harmful effects of accumulating pollution in our environment is spurring epigenetic research across the country, a sign of legal issues to come. Federica Pereira is a professor at Columbia University and director of the Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health, where they are studying 737 healthy pregnant women and their fetuses, hoping to follow these children and epigenetic marks through a lifetime. She started her observations in 1997. The oldest child in the study is now 14. The results are showing that environmental toxins are in fact showing an epigenetic outcome. Potential grounds for a lawsuit?
The women are fairly young and they're healthy. They're non-smoking, and so they don't have obvious risk factors for poor birth outcomes or difficulties, you know, for the children later on. They are healthy and low risk.
The main goal is to evaluate the effects of common environmental exposures during the prenatal window of development on children's health, as well as other outcomes such as obesity and metabolic disorders.
The pollutants that we're studying, and we're studying them in the context of the social and psychosocial stressors that often affect women during pregnancy and following delivery. We're also looking at genetic and nutritional factors that could affect susceptibility of the children to poor outcomes. But our main focus is on the environmental exposures that are occurring every day in urban areas, that is to traffic and traffic emissions, fossil fuel combustion in general. A lot of that is from traffic, but some from heating units in buildings, oil burning, some imported from coal burning sources, upwind. And we're also looking at pesticides that are used to control household pests, endocrine disrupting chemicals like phthalates and bisphenol A that are found in consumer products and in food and in personal care products for phthalates. We're also looking at environmental tobacco smoke and flame retardants, PBDEs. So many different exposures that we're able to measure.
So far, published results are showing a connection between in utero environmental exposures and future physical and mental health of the babies in the study.
That is decreased fetal growth and poor scoring on different cognitive and behavioral testing instruments. So those exposures include the air pollutants that we're studying called PAHs and pesticides and secondhand smoke and some of the others. The effects are not always in the same domain for different chemical exposures. But what we're showing is that there are multiple exposures that could individually have modest adverse effects. But when we think about the real life situation, we have to think about the additional burden of the effects of each one added upon the others. So that's an important point because we are very dedicated in our work to providing policy relevant data that could be useful in terms of thinking about how best to protect pregnant women and children starting at that very early age of susceptible period of development.
Janine LaSalle, professor of immunology at UC Davis, is also at the forefront of epigenetic studies. Her laboratory is interested in the role of epigenetics in human autism spectrum disorders.
My mother was a public health nurse and my father was a physicist, so somewhere, I think what I'm doing now is somewhere in between those two, I guess. I was always interested in science, I think, in school, and sort of studied biology. And I actually, my PhD is in immunology, but I got interested in genetics in my postdoc, and that's how I got into epigenetics and Prader-Willi and Angelman syndrome, and I just thought they were really interesting, and it was sort of fascinating. And it's kind of interesting now that some of the work that I'm coming back to involves collaboration with people in immunology, and epigenetics really is that kind of bridge between the multiple disciplines. So it's, you know, even though you think you're completely switching fields, I think you still come back to some of the things you've learned in the past.
Most recently, LaSalle led a study linking genetics and epigenetics with exposure to a flame retardant chemical. LaSalle and her team of graduate students genetically engineered mice to be susceptible to autism-like behaviors. The mice exposed to a common flame retardant were less fertile and their offspring were smaller, less sociable, and demonstrated deficits in learning and long-term memory. The research was published online in February 2012 in the journal Human Molecular Genetics. The autism rate in the U.S. is astonishingly high. According to the Centers for Disease Control, an average of 1 in 110 children have an autism spectrum disorder.
It's hard for even the epidemiologists to sort out that question because it is, I think there's a lot more awareness now of autism, and I think some of the epidemiology studies, you know, where they look for things like environmental clustering, or even if you look, the CDC did a study, but it was based on school reporting, and there were differences between states, and like New Jersey had the highest, and I think some like Alabama or South Carolina had some of the lowest. And so at first you're like, oh yeah, I mean, New Jersey has a reputation for the environmental hazards, but it also is probably likely just the education level of the parents. And actually that was done, my collaborator Irva Hertz-Pichotto did this in a clustering analysis in California, looking again sort of what they do for cancer. Are there areas that show up with increased rates. And they did find clustering, but the clustering was basically in the sort of most highly educated areas and focusing around the regional centers for autism. So it's something like awareness of autism and probably good health care, you know, being able to go in and get diagnosis early. And I think actually when that came out, it was good timing, right? I think right before the healthcare bill. So I think because a similar study in Denmark, where everyone gets screened for autism by age 3, didn't see a socioeconomic difference. So it was kind of striking in this country how, you know, the autism is higher based on your socioeconomic bracket. And it's probably, unfortunately, just these are the aware parents that have healthcare and are getting their kids tested. Whereas it's probably higher in the other communities, but maybe they're not being reached.
Is the rate still high, even with maternal age factored in or excluded from that? You know, it's not just that it's...
Yeah, obviously it's not just older mothers or we'd all be in trouble. But it's just, you know, it's similar to things like Down syndrome and Prader-Willi. The uniparental disomy for Prader-Willi is also with increased maternal age. And a lot of that's just the biologic fact that their eggs sit their whole life. And so the longer they sit, the longer you're going to potentially have genetic and potentially epigenetic abnormalities. So I think it's most things like that will increase with maternal age.
Industry statistics suggest autism spectrum disorders currently affect 4 times as many males as females. When it comes to boys, the autism rate is 1 in 70.
Males in development are more susceptible in general to things like environmental insults, so that could be part of it. I think there's a lot of interesting questions. Or the other thing is there could be hormonal differences. The testosterone during in utero development for the males has been speculated to sort of drive more of the analytical brain rather than a social brain.
Let's hit the pause button. As women who know plenty of women who are both analytical and social, we have to stop and question this last point. Are male brains really designed to be more analytical and female brains less so?
No.
That's a controversial topic that deserves further attention, and we'll be sure to explore it in the near future. For now, we are sticking to autism and another contentious issue, vaccinations. A recent study showed that 1 in 4 parents is concerned that vaccines can cause autism. The study that started the autism vaccine scare was recently retracted. Delaying vaccines or choosing not to get one can be risky.
That's a very hot button question. But no, I think, I mean, my perspective, and again, I'm a parent too, so I, you know, thought twice about vaccinations, although I think the problem comes in this field is, you know, you don't react immediately. I mean, somebody may have an idea for discussion. Could it be, you know, I think a lot of us are sort of speculating now, could it be this, could it be that in the environment? And immunizations were a reasonable, you know, choice to look at. And I think if it, the good thing that's come of that whole sort of controversy is I think that they probably were reaching the boundary of how much thimerosal and bad chemicals, and so I think getting that out of the immunizations is probably a good thing. I think the bad thing to come out of that is a lot of parents have chosen not to immunize their children, and now we're seeing the effects of that in sort of outbreaks of these diseases that really should have not be there. As a parent, you want to read everything, and you're concerned, and anything you can eliminate that may be a potential cause or a trigger in your children, I could see wanting to eliminate that, but I think it's not good to do that at the expense of good things, which, again, I think vaccination does a lot of good. I think it's obviously right to question, are we giving too much? Should certain things be taken out of the vaccines? But, I mean, all the evidence, at least at the whole population level, has shown that there's really no connection between vaccination and autism. So, I mean, but again, anecdotally, if there are people who say, I'm convinced in my child that this is what it was, I can understand that. But I think the challenge is, again, with a regressive syndrome, and this is what I was trying to point out this morning, you think my child was fine a month ago, and suddenly they lost words that they had, they started to do this weird rocking stereotypic behavior. You want to blame what happened to him last week. I think that's just normal human reaction. But what I would like to point out is that you can have genetic syndromes that also go, and Rett syndrome is a good example of that. Normal, and it's devastating for parents. I mean, I've talked to a lot of parents with this, and they said, you know, my child was normal. She, you know, they have pictures, and then suddenly it's like they're being stolen away, you know, that they lose language they may have gained, that they lose purposeful hand movement, they start going in their own world and doing stereotypic behaviors. So I mean, I can see that normal reaction to blame what happened right before the regression. But I think really for exposures, the critical timing is when you've got this tiny little embryo and everything's getting set, especially, you know, that first month of pregnancy is, unfortunately, and most women don't even realize they're pregnant, and that's the really critical time for a lot of things that are happening. So, again, that's something you can't change once you have the child, but I think that if maybe more public messages going out of how critical this is for women considering pregnancy, and I think the prenatal vitamin thing is another case of there have been a lot of speculation in the field prior, really not based on any data, that, you know, maybe folate is a bad thing because it's been added since, you know, again, so the, if we believe that there's a rise in the incidence of autism, could this be something that's changed? And folate and the, well, the recommendation to do folic acid supplementation and also the supplementation to the food supply is definitely something that should be questioned, but the evidence now is really that it is protective, but it's only protective if you take it, you know, in that preconception period. I mean, I think 90% of women are taking it at their first prenatal visit, but not before that, and I think it's really, that's an important health message to get out.
Still, no matter what precautions you take, the pollutants you or your parents were exposed to can affect your offspring, and that's where law and ethics collide. How far back can we trace the blame? For instance, polychlorinated biphenyl, or PCBs, a byproduct of coal tar, was first introduced into the atmosphere in 1914. Monsanto Company took over commercial production of it in 1929 for cooling and insulating fluids in electric motors. In 1936, several documented medical cases linked PCBs with detrimental health effects, such as endocrine disruption and neurotoxicity. The U.S. government finally banned the use of PCBs in 1979. In 1936, several documented medical cases linked PCBs with detrimental health effects, such as endocrine disruption and neurotoxicity. The U.S. government finally banned the use of PCBs in 1979.
But yet we're still seeing detectable levels in brains of kids that were born since the ban. And, you know, is that something, could there have been an epigenetic change based on exposures that we've already gotten rid of, and that's coming back in this next generation? I think it's a really interesting question, an unresolved question. It's still always going to be a correlation analysis because you don't know if it came from something else, but it is intriguing that you can still find some of these compounds that we think we've kind of eliminated in the... But the problem with the organic pollutants is they bioaccumulate up the food chain, so they're really hard to get rid of because they go to lipid-rich tissues. So, you know, animals have them, you know, things like polar bears that have, you know, the top of the food chain. Yeah, and the Inuits that eat a lot of fish. So it is a bit concerning that it's that sometimes, you know, we don't know the impact of the chemicals until afterwards, and then sometimes it's hard to get rid of them.
LaSalle's lab looks at multiple pollutants to determine if they contribute to autism. Flame retardant is one of focus, but LaSalle uses extreme caution before making conclusions.
I think based on our results, I mean, it's interesting, we saw an interesting interaction in the mouse model. I don't think that this is a smoking gun for autism, so I'll say that, because we really didn't see it higher in the autism brains, and then in another study that was done at the Mind Institute, they didn't see it higher in autism blood. But I will talk, I mean, it still is a concern because these are on the rise in the environment. Again, they're chemically related to PCBs that were banned in the 70s, but we really still haven't gotten rid of. And the concern is that really everything these days, they don't want to catch on fire, they put it in. So it's you're taking one risk, which is things catching on fire, and exchanging it for another risk, which is this chemical that, again, is a concern about making epigenetic changes in the developing embryo. And if it's not at risk for autism, we definitely saw a fertility effect. So it could be impacting the fertility of people, especially if they have a genetic susceptibility on top of that. That's what we saw in the mice. So I think, you know, I don't want to go against the chemical industry either, but it's a concern. I think that we always should be questioning the products we have in our home, and is it really necessary to have this much of a chemical. Obviously, it's important for things not to catch on fire, but when you start adding up the amount of this compound that you're exposed to, and the fact that it really takes a long time to get rid of these compounds, they're in our food supply. The epidemiology study that was done in California through the Mind Institute, again, didn't see an increase in autism, but what was striking is the levels were, I think, at least 10 tenfold higher than had been done previously in Sweden. And in Europe, they have banned these compounds. So it is a concern, you know, maybe not so much for this generation, but what, these are in our environment and we'll need to, you know, what's the impact on the future? And I think PCBs is a good example that even once you have banned it, it still can come back to haunt human health.
This is a great ethical question. Whether the sense that these are future generations will impress upon policymakers the necessity of making sure that we avoid exposures, that we provide treatment and care for people so that they can reverse the epigenetic marks and so on.
Is it on the radar of policymakers now?
No, it's not on the radar, it's not on the sonar, it's not on the map, it's nowhere. So if you look at the laws that have been enacted, the word epigenetics doesn't appear. We enacted legislation in the United States in 2008 prohibiting genetic discrimination in employment and health insurance. And the way the statute is worded, it doesn't cover epigenetics. So we need to kind of back up and rethink whether we want to include epigenetics in terms of regulation. There are no OSHA standards that are based on the fact that there are epigenetic harms caused by environmental toxicants. EPA and FDA have heard of epigenetics, but they've really yet to integrate epigenetic analysis into their rulemaking and regulating substances. So the law often lags the science, but we need to be thinking more about where we're going with the law and with the ethics.
Are the legal areas and policy areas, are they going to have to change because of the data that's coming out?
I think in many respects they will have to change. So let me give you an example. Suppose that our current regulations of substance X demonstrate that they're insufficient to prevent epigenetic damage, which may not manifest itself in individuals immediately, maybe years later, forgetting the transgenerational possibilities. That means now that we may have to go back and take a look at what the exposure level maximum that's in the workplace or in the environment or in water or whatever. And so, yes, it's going to have widespread implications.
If bioethicist Mark Rothstein is successful in his mission, epigenetics will shed a new light on the impact of environmental pollutants on society and the necessity, from an ethical perspective, to address the growing list of diseases related to environmental pollutants. Ultimately, to understand the obligations individuals in society will have for the health and well-being of the most vulnerable people in society and their descendants, generations into the future.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. Thank you for listening.
Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.